Thieves Gap is rock, but if we just have sand, clay, and so forth, then the banks it can spread out. So what happens is you have a certain amount of sediment and water coming down, and it will self-adjust the channel shape and the size to the bank margin strength. That makes sense.
Is there what we see the formation of a point bar and of a caving bank right there?
Here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe we could explain to people what that
is. I'm tired of these things already. So.
Well, they were so easy.
Brian asked me to do this, and I'd never done it before, and so I made a form and started bending acrylic, and that's kind of like. They're too curved, actually. But of course, the river is curved too.
Right.
And it's a lot more interesting, of course, if you force the water to turn that corner.
Yeah.
You know, you get, and the levees in the rock, of course, do that. Mm-hmm. Not always, but a lot of times. Mm-hmm.
Chicago Land's contribution to the Mississippi, does that get measured discreetly, or does that just get measured in the floodwaters? Right, like if the waters are swelling and we're getting flooded and sending all our rain and gray water down here, yeah. Is there any way we can gauge the input from Chicago Land into the system?
Oh gosh, I don't think so, not at this point.
So it really does all become like one water, in essence.
There's a major permeability, circle the same permeability in square miles, and you can calculate how much rain falls on that, and then how much of it, you know, doesn't actually flows off an impermeable surface.
Because, you know, so when it was flooding down here, we were also flooding, so we were sending more down as more was coming, and so that's like this dynamic that always becomes invisible. And like,
sure,
it's impossible to say, Chicago, like, wait a second, you know, we're saying, oh, poor downstate communities, but we're also sending more.
Oh, it is possible. There are people whose job it is to do that.
To measure how much is going in.
Well, they use modeling and so forth, and they know there are thousands of stream gauges in the United States, so they can look at all the stream gauges in the dendritic network and see what's flowing past all the different areas. And so, yeah, there's somebody out there that can tell you. You know, if Chicago is outputting 2.3 million cubic feet per second of Chicago water, how much of that is crop passing the Mississippi? So yeah, I'm just telling you, it's going to be pretty small. Think about a map of the lake states and how big of an area Chicago is. And
there are maps of impermeable surfaces, and that's why they exist, because the contribution to flash flooding of urban areas is actually significant. The urban areas are big, and so for the wide Mississippi, it's not significant, but for flash flooding effects, it's very significant.
No, I have colleagues that do that. Just I can't recall anybody ever saying, I wonder what the impact of Chicago is on the Thieves Gap.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's not a legitimate
question. And could you ever, this is another, you know, maybe question that no one asks but me. Could you ever, like, follow a drop? Right, could you ever, like, trace a drop of water, say, or an amount of water through the system? You know what I mean? Like
cutting a molecule.
Yeah, kind of like follow, you know, so that you could have a visual of how, you know.
Tagging the cesium or strontium or something.
Right.
Finding it like
they are.
Yeah.
There
are. Yeah. I mean,
there
are. They're rising above the background level of the
carbon. There is a science that uses fluorescent dye, you know. So they do that a lot over in the Ozarks to track the cave springs and what's called the underground rivers and so forth. They will inject fluorescein. You know, it's detectable at a fraction of part per billion with ultraviolet light, so you could do it that way. But there's an awful lot of pollution.
It would have, but that's quite,
you know, factors of millions.
I have a quick question. So obviously, as a scale model of space, if I'm just making this up, but right, if this is a mile or whatever, obviously these bits of plastic sediment are moving faster than they would. So down the space. So what kind of time? What accelerated timeline does this represent, given the reduced physical scale, so the spatial scale changes the... Is this basically, are we watching sort of days go by with every second?
Oh, yeah,
or
yeah, no,
what's
this
the...
ultra speeded up.
Yeah.
Although, you know, for a small Ozark stream, some of the ones I've worked on this, it wouldn't be speeded up very much in a big flood.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh,
yeah,
right,
you can
right.
See, you can see a cut bank like that move, you know, 50 meters in one flood. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, for a large river, it's, and there's a whole science of that called hydraulic similitude that is...
Yeah, okay.
Awesome. That's one of the nice things I like about this model is how it changes very, I mean, from my knowledge, very accurately, but it does it in such a time frame that, you know, you don't have to come back every week and look at the same spot and figure it out. But just how quickly it changes. I know it speeded up. I remember, like, you know, when you pull that little snag out, just the entire character from that point down changed almost.
And we do a lot of time lapse, so we speed it up even more.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of really cool things. In fact, if you go to our website, we have dozens and dozens of videos. A lot of them are shot with a lot of technical skill in here and to be used for education that show you some of those processes. In fact, there's one about levee failure. Brian, I can't remember if I pointed you to that one.
The one in Japan?
Yeah, it's got it's easy to spot because it's got Japanese overdub, and it's Akio, our friend, who, thank God, is safe. I just heard her this morning. She's close to Tokyo. She overdubbed it in Japanese, but it's about the release of energy when levees fail, which is a problem that they're having right now, and they've had a lot of those problems in Japan. They have a lot of levees.
Could you explain more?
What's that?
Explain more, could you explain more?
Oh, they got over 2 feet of rain in places around... I don't know the exact geographic locations. The New York Times, either the Times or the Post had a really amazing photo essay this morning. If you want to look at that.
This morning?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, God, it's a devastation.
I think it was close to Kyoto, wasn't it?
It's a Fukushima right now, I think.
I don't know. I just know that the Tokyo area got hit really hard, but the winds diminished. I think it was only a Cat 1 by our standards when it hit the coast, but they still got 90 mile an hour winds. They got over 2 feet of rain, and the Japanese landscapes are really vulnerable to that. They're vulnerable to landslides because they have a lot of steep, relatively geologically young landscapes that respond to rain like that. Of course, when you start building infrastructure on them, that makes them a whole lot more likely to slide. You see those slides a lot, and you can see they originated with oil.
Right.
You know, cutting a road into the side of a hillside is just a great way. It's like scratching the glass before you crack it.
It
destabilizes the slope. So,
I'm wondering if geologists are interested in this because of, you know, yesterday we took a walk with a geologist and two geologists, and they were talking about reading the sedimentary rock and the layering of. And then the dynamics, you know, of something, a river bringing something over something else. And have you had interest in geologists? Or?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah,
I know. Geoscientists are our main clients.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. No, probably 80% of our models go there, especially the larger, expensive research units in the geoscience departments. Now, they love the color-coded media. It's really fun to see them when they see it the first time and they see the layering. I've seen literally the jaw would drop, you know, like, oh my God, because you can't see that process. Nobody's ever visualized it before, ever.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, those years you worked for free.
Yeah, you can see it's not too strong. Sometimes it's very strong, but you can see
that. Yeah, the strength.
You can see the. It's a lot stronger if you sort of do it on purpose.
Uh huh.
See there, you can see
you
the difference.
Could you show us what happens when you deepen a channel?
Yeah, this is one of the things these models get used for a lot is the effects of in-channel gravel removal. Mm-hmm. Something that surprises everybody is see this traveling upstream.
Yeah.
You talk to gravel miners and they will say that's ridiculous. There's no way I have an upstream impact. You know, everybody knows water goes downstream, and they will add, you know, you ignorant college boy. I've been threatened with violence a couple times. I'm not joking. Like, what kind of idiot do you think I am, you know? But So I've spent a lot of my career trying to convince those people. And that's one of the reasons I developed these in the first place. But look at this. See this? Yeah. This is called a head cut. And if you mine gravel here, you will often cause this. And there are places in Asia where whole sections of river have just been destroyed and major bridges have failed, and even dams have failed. Because you may have read about it recently, there's this huge need for aggregate, for sand and gravel, for concrete, for this incredibly growing economy. And the easiest place in the world to get it is right out of the river. And so they want to mine it out of the rivers. Fortunately, it's crummy aggregate. It's not good aggregate. In fact, in a lot of places down here, I know in St. Louis, for example, where I've done a lot of work, you're not allowed to use it for concrete because it's rounded and it's quartz and it makes very bad aggregate. It causes the concrete to crack.
But they like it for cracking, doesn't it? Rounded sand. Introduced this species that was going to be a living fence. It turned out to be a living nightmare.
You can't go to any public meeting without someone, well, they're probably all dying now. They're older than me, so they're dying off, but. Yeah, you guys told us about multiple roads, not great for us. So it's not, it doesn't come, the distrust doesn't come out of nowhere.
Can I ask a question about log versus digital simulation? Like, what can this do that a digital simulation of fluvial dynamics can't do?
I'm of the opinion that we will never understand. This is mixed phase flow. It's a fluid and a solid together, mm-hmm. a granulated solid. Mm-hmm. And I've seen digital simulations of particle behavior that just mm-hmm. blow my mind. You know, where they dump a bunch of rubber balls into a virtual clear acrylic box and they bounce around and it just absolutely blows my mind. It's realistic. But this is mixed phase flow. It's water and particles. And I know a lot about the theory of how this works. And from what I know about the theory, I don't think we'll ever have enough information to model it accurately.
It's too complicated.
It's too damn complicated.
Well, because of variability of the two things you're looking at at the beginning.
Right. Yeah. Well, if you look at like James Glick's book, Chaos, which is mm-hmm. a really neat book, I mean, he talks about turbulence in every chapter and how. I mean, do you really think that bubble that just passed, if I had all the information about that, I could tell you what would happen to that bubble by the time it got down to the bottom?
There was a great moment in the history of the Mississippi River when Einstein's son was brought to the old river control structure to model the river and produce the equation that would tell how big the dam should be, where it should be, and so on. And after 6 months or so, Einstein's son probably had to concede that his equations were not enough to.
Yeah. Well, there's stuff that happens at the molecular level that it just. The initial conditions are so super sensitive mm-hmm. that I don't lose any sleep at night worrying about somebody doing this on a digital level and making it. Plus, how much fun would that be?
Yeah, and the governor's not going to convince by someone showing a digital model on a laptop. That's something about physicality.
It's a lot easier to argue against the digital model.
Do you ever have people?
Well, you also have things like.
Yeah. Well, that's true, and we have people who say this is a magic trick. Very good.
That's right.
Very few, but that's
how
usually
do you,
the other people go, if, no.
How do you frame that degree of uncertainty, though, when you're talking to people or stakeholders about making actual decisions? Because you said about the gravel mining example. So do you have to position that if people want to make real decisions around things? How do you?
I probably should have covered this earlier in my talk, but these are what the scientists would call process models. They show general processes. They don't. I would never pretend that this could do any sort of prediction about an individual case. It's like a balsa wood airplane in a wind tunnel that you can learn how lift and drag and all that works, but you're not going to model an A380 Boeing jet whether it's going to fly right with the ball. You know. So these are the balsa wood models that they do an amazing job of showing all the processes. But setting up a particular situation and trying to predict this, people do it, but it's nearly impossible and it's not fun at all. You have to distort everything so much it doesn't look like the ultimate site, actually. Because there's about 8 variables and none of them are linear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, and gravity stays the same, which is why Godzilla used to look so fake. When he waited, I have a whole talk called the Godzilla effect. The old time Godzilla before CGI, he's only 6 feet tall, but he's supposed to be 80 meters. And when he wades into the ocean, which he does a lot, right, he always looks fake because of all those scaling factors.
What
they slow the video down, you know, so the water splashes.
And then he makes a time.
And you can actually see all the different components of the modeling variables in the old Godzilla. And he always looks fake.
Steve, do you have some closing remarks? Because soon this would be the time. Does anyone
have
some closing questions?
No, I covered everything that you wanted to.
I think it's brilliant. I think it's been fantastic. People might have some more questions.
Yeah, please.
Great. I love this. I mean, just as a demonstration showing how that stuff works in a time frame that, you know, it's like some farmer that's dragged a snag out of a river is going to recognize that, you know, and he goes, yeah, I did that. And, you know, I mean, Kimmy comes back next year, and you know, why is his lower 40 flooded, you know, or whatever. But
Yeah, these have helped make a huge shift.
They had a particular
probably 25% of our models get used for field public outreach.
How heavy is
one that circulates around the watershed that feeds the Great Barrier Reef? I didn't realize that until I ordered one. The big threat to the Great Barrier Reef is actually the land use of the watershed. It's kind of like the dead zone situation. So they have one of these in a van that goes around. They have the same hard-headed farmers in Australia.
I have a question. How do you feel about being brought into an art context?
Oh, I love it. I've been waiting for it for a long time.
Yeah.
I've worked really hard to make these beautiful. Uh-huh. And my videos, too. I have that. So, and plus, if they're ugly, people aren't going to watch them. No, I think it's awesome. The potential for this sort of technology, artistic, visual use is crazy high. Actually, we've started selling to landscape architects. They have this. They're in this very weird world that bridges science and art. Like they get paid to study aesthetics, you know, human aesthetics. And so they're using these models now and doing crazy artistic stuff instead of more hard science stuff that we have to do. So most of our clients are not interested in that. I mean, they are personally. They can't. And the grant money's not going to pay for it because it's pretty. This one sits, this is about probably $16,000 or $17,000.
Okay.
I'm not sure. The color-coded media has a lot, and we have media that's not color-coded. Okay. This stuff is just so crazy expensive. So. Yeah, they go from 5,000 up to, we have a new robotic model that will be $250,000 probably.
But you keep doing the R&D. Just doesn't stop. Sorry.
I gave my folks a little lecture about that last week. That R&D can't go on
forever. Oh, I see.
Remember that 10 years I worked without getting paid?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I'm 61, so I kind of need to start.
Well, you're
getting some of that back. I'm not rich.
That was a great gift to a lot of people. Your 10 years of not being paid.
Thank you. I'll call you when I'm old and poor.
Dude.
But no, R&D can go on forever, but you have to really watch it. So
yeah.
Well, we have lots of instrumentation, digital, and we make all of our own boards and code and all that stuff.
And make a good coffee.
We're in the process of networking all of that, so you can hook it up to a PC and all sorts of things. We have a robotic model that moves around.
That's going on the field notes.
So R&D on that stuff could be endless if you like. There's always something cooler or neater to add to it. Exactly, that's what it already has. And then video and still and close range photogrammetry. And, yeah, all kinds of stuff. Laser scanning.
What are the acrylic cylinders?
I just put those in there. You guys might want to play on. You always have bridge abutments in these rivers, yeah. And it's one of the big engineering problems is keeping those from scouring out and the towboats hit them.
So everybody now is going to be the time to go out and get on the buses. But before that, a big hand for Steve Goff and Literary